This week we will be studying 1 Kings 12, 25 through 13, 10. We'll also supplement this with 2 Chronicles 11, 13 through 17, which we skipped over last week, and some further consideration of 1 Kings 11 concerning Ahijah's prophecy to Jeroboam. Last week in the first half of 1 Kings 12, we studied Rehoboam's folly, in which he oppressed the people and split the kingdom, with Rehoboam becoming king over the southern kingdom of Judah and Jeroboam becoming king over the northern kingdom of Israel. This week our emphasis will be on Jeroboam and his disastrously bad leadership. Jeroboam, out of a lack of trust in God, will set up idols and lead the people into worshiping them. This is a serious wrong, and it will remind us to avoid the sin of idolatry, but more than that, it will remind us to trust in God by following his commands instead of following our own ideas. Your passage for consideration then is 1 Kings 12, 25 through 13, 10, and if you have not read it yet, I recommend that you pause and do so now. First, let's give today's passage a little context. The last couple of chapters in 1 Kings have focused on the split between Israel and Judah. Last week, we emphasized what happened with the king of Judah on Rehoboam's end of the split. From this point on, the book of 1 Kings is going to do some ping-ponging back and forth between kings in the south and their corresponding kings in the north. But note that we use 2 Chronicles as our primary passage for consideration. The events in 2 Chronicles will mirror those of 1 and 2 Kings, but there is a distinction. Where the books of Kings tell the stories of the kings from both the northern and southern kingdoms, 2 Chronicles will only tell the stories of the southern kings of Judah. So 1 Kings introduced Jeroboam, rival northern king to Rehoboam, in chapter 11, in which a prophet foretold that Jeroboam would become king of a portion of the tribes. The opening of 1 Kings 12 describes the split between the tribes, and today's content and on into chapter 14 describes Jeroboam's reign and important events that happened therein. So, since we're discussing Jeroboam, let's look back at 1 Kings 11, 29 through 36 to discuss the prophecy that predicted how he would become king. I find a mathematical difficulty in that passage. The prophecy went this way. The prophet Ahijah tore his cloak into 12 pieces. He gave Jeroboam 10 pieces, saying that Jeroboam would get 10 tribes, leaving one for Solomon's son Rehoboam. In fact, he says that more than once, 10 for Jeroboam and one for Rehoboam. I find that math to be confusing for several reasons. First, 10 tribes plus one tribe is 11 tribes. So after Ahijah tore his cloak into 12 pieces, giving 10 to Jeroboam and giving one to Rehoboam, there was a piece left over. Ahijah didn't say what would happen to that piece. It also isn't clear which tribe it would represent. But then, there's always been a little bit of slippery math when calculating how many tribes there are. For example, Jacob had 12 sons, but both of Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, were counted as tribes. That brings the total number of tribes up to 13. Then, when land was allotted, Manasseh got two shares, one on the east and the other on the west of the Jordan. So arguably, despite the fact that the scriptures are comfortable talking about the 12 tribes of Israel, we could count as many as 14. Then again, there could also be as few as 10. If all the descendants of Joseph were counted as one tribe of Joseph, that would bring us back to 12, and the sons of Levi, who received no land allotment, were not counted, then that would bring the count down to 11 tribes. But also, the tribe of Simeon was so weak as to perhaps not be counted. Simeon's land allotment was entirely surrounded by Judah's land. After the time of David's reign, mentions of Simeon as a tribe are rare. 1 Chronicles 4, which gives a listing of some cities of Simeon, mentions in verse 31 that these were their cities until David reigned. That might suggest to us that the Simeonites maintained local control until David's time, but then no more. That same chapter also tells of how, in Hezekiah's time, some of the Simeonites migrated to Mount Seir, Edomite territory, and others migrated to an area east of Gedor, a city in Judah. This indicates to us that the Simeonites did not completely lose their genealogical tribal identity, but might also suggest that they did not strictly maintain their land allotment. It also tells us that the Simeonites were still hanging around after the northern kingdom went into exile, so there's a strong suggestion that Simeon stuck with Judah. 2 Chronicles 15:9 also mentions Simeonites during Asa's reign, but that verse seems to suggest that there were a relatively few Simeonites sojourning in Judah, rather than Judah taking all of Simeon. Going against the idea that Simeon was counted as a region of Judah, we note that none of Simeon's cities are mentioned in the cities that were fortified by Rehoboam. But just because he didn't fortify them doesn't mean that he didn't count them as being in his territory. If we were to count Simeon as being part of the region of Judah, then we might say that there are as few as 10 tribes. So the first part of the question is how many tribes are there, but as shown, we could count a number anywhere between 10 and 14, but the prophet tore 12 pieces of cloth, giving away only 11 of them, at least one tribe missing. So who knows? This is further complicated in that Rehoboam arguably ended up with more than one tribe. Clearly, Rehoboam maintained control of Judah. He also maintained control of at least part of, and maybe all of, Benjamin. In 1 Kings 12:21, right after the Israelites rejected Rehoboam as king, Rehoboam was able to muster at least some troops from among the Benjaminites. As we noted last week, Rehoboam also possessed the city of Aijalon, which had been allotted to the tribe of Dan. Now, the Danites never did have full control of their territory, and many of them had moved on from it to the north long ago. Did Rehoboam's rule over the city of Aijalon represent a share in the tribe of Dan? Or was Aijalon simply counted as a city of Judah by that time, abandoned by the Danites? We also consider the tribe of the Levites. In 2 Chronicles 11:13 through 16, which we will give additional consideration today, we read that after the split, the Levites left Israel and migrated to Judah so that they could continue in Jehovah's service. Whether this was the entire tribe or a portion of it, I suppose, is uncertain, but the passage seems to suggest all of them. And then Simeon, as mentioned previously. My point then is this: there could be anything from 10 to 14 tribes, depending on how exactly we count, and anywhere from 1 to 4 of them could have gone to Rehoboam, depending on what percentages went with him and what we count, with whatever remained, anywhere from 9 to 13 tribes going to Jeroboam. So while the imagery of tearing a cloak into 12 pieces and giving Rehoboam only one piece might be a potent symbol, the math here and the facts surrounding it are unclear in such a way that I don't think we can give a clean explanation of exactly what the prophet meant. And I'm sure that there could be a variety of explanations. Perhaps this is all symbolism. Or maybe the 12 tribes are the 12 sons of Israel, and Rehoboam only technically got Judah while Jeroboam got everything else, and the tribe of Simeon, or maybe Levi, doesn't really count, so his scrap of fabric was pulled out. And whatever territory Judah got in Dan was just a sliver, and Benjamin was split, so that they mostly went to Jeroboam and didn't count as going to Rehoboam. A solution like that is messy, but it would be correct enough. Who knows what the intent was? Whatever the right solution is, I'm sure that there is a solution that works out well enough that we can take the prophet's proclamation as true, even without fully understanding the details. Unfortunately, the information that we have is incomplete and unclear. And then we come to today's passage itself. First things first, Jeroboam set up his capital at Shechem, which we discussed last week. He also fortified Penuel. That's another city that we've seen mentioned now and then since Genesis. Penuel was on the east of the Jordan, where Jacob wrestled with God. I get the impression, reading the Bible, that a lot of traffic passed through there, so this was probably an important city to fortify to protect against invaders from the east. But in verses 26 through 27, we read about Jeroboam's fear. He wanted to maintain control of the people, and he recognized that religion was a way to maintain control. Now, obviously, that is not all that religion is. God is not some man-made construct whose sole purpose is to control people. But God can be used that way. If people believe in a God and fear his power, and a man sets himself up as the mouthpiece of that God, then whatever he says carries an additional weight. That, of course, is why the Bible takes false prophecy and the worship of false gods so seriously. If you take a look back at Deuteronomy 13, you will see that making false prophecies and leading people to worship false gods carries the death penalty. The power of God is not to be usurped. But Jeroboam recognized the power that religion has, and he recognized that the religion of his people in Israel was not under his control, and that scared him. Jehovah's temple was in Jerusalem, which was in Rehoboam's territory in the kingdom of Judah, and so Jeroboam thought that if the people would continue to worship Jehovah, then they would go to Judah to worship, and Jeroboam feared that this would give them a familiarity and comfort with Rehoboam and his kingdom. They would be impressed by the great works in Jerusalem, and perhaps Rehoboam would manipulate the worship of Jehovah in such a way as to persuade the Israelites to return to him. Maybe the priests would say that dividing the kingdom was a grave sin for which they would be punished. Maybe they would refuse to allow Israelites to sacrifice there and tell them that their sins remained upon them. Jeroboam envisioned a future in which Rehoboam would sway the people in this way, and they would return to him to rejoin the kingdom. And then they would kill Jeroboam as a rebel. And so in Jeroboam's mind, maintaining his kingdom meant that Israel would need its own independent national religion. And that is not very bright. The people had chosen to leave Rehoboam's kingdom, religion or not. While we can understand Jeroboam's reasoning, the fact is that Jeroboam was king in Israel because God had made him king. In chapter 11, a prophet had told him that he would become king of Israel and that the thing would be from God. And not only that, but in chapter 11, verse 38, we read the promise that God gave him. And if you will listen to all that I command you, and will walk in my ways, and do what is right in my eyes by keeping my statutes and my commandments, as David my servant did, I will be with you and will build you a sure house as I built for David, and I will give Israel to you. So Jeroboam had two options here. He could choose to either A, obey Jehovah's commands and receive a house like David's, or B, disbelieve Jehovah's promise by disobeying Jehovah's commands and try to build the kingdom for himself. Tragically, he chose B, incorrectly. Jeroboam made the foolish decision to set up a new religion and try to build the kingdom his way apart from God. Now for us, looking back at this, the decision looks completely nonsensical, but we really don't know what kind of man Jeroboam was when he received that prophecy. For all we know, he never really believed that the word of the prophet had come from God, and he never expected it to be fulfilled. Perhaps all this time he thought the prophet was just some nut, and he attributed the split of the kingdom to his own political maneuvering. But whatever he was thinking, he chose not to trust Jehovah. Jeroboam set up two new places of worship so that the people would not go down to Jerusalem. He put the places at Bethel and Dan. Bethel was in the south of Israel and Dan was in the north, so there was access to the idols on both sides of the country. Bethel was in the central part of Israel east to west, but running north to south, its latitude is only about 5 miles north of Ajalon's latitude. We have previously identified Ajalon as a city in Judah's control, so apparently, presuming a straight east-west border, which I'm not sure is safe, the border ran somewhere in that 5 mile window. And that would make a lot of sense if Benjamin's allotment was completely within Judah, because Bethel had been the northern border for the Benjaminites. Bethel has been noted many other times in Scripture. Its name means House of God, and it is the place where Jacob saw the angels ascending and descending on his famous ladder. Dan was on the extreme north of Israel. You will recall how in Judges 18 we have a story of the Danites being unable to conquer their territory, and so some sizable portion of them went north to a city which had been called Laish and conquered it to live there. They renamed the city Dan, and even in that story at that early time, the Danites demonstrated a propensity to idolatry. And so Jeroboam set up idols in these places, one north and one south, so that no one has to cross the borders to get to a place of worship. What idols did he set up? Golden calves. I've said it before, the human obsession with worshiping cows is strange to me. I get it, I guess. If you work with cows, maybe you could think that a cow god could fix your problems. Cows are symbols of wealth because they provide meat and milk, so they're valuable. They're also big, strong animals with sharp horns. Humans like the idea of being big and strong and tough and wealthy. But worshiping cows is never going to get you what you're after. Cows are also filthy and stupid, and if you worship cows, you're more likely to end up like that. Perhaps Jeroboam chose to make cow idols in direct reference to the idol which Aaron had made in the wilderness. We covered that in our message, The Golden Calf, published on August 12th of 2018. If you don't remember, back in Exodus 32, while Moses was on the mountain receiving God's laws, Aaron was with the people and they demanded that he hurry up and give them the new religion they'd been waiting for. So Aaron made a golden calf and, just like Jeroboam, proclaimed that the golden calf god had brought them out of the land of Egypt. Maybe Jeroboam tried to play it off that Aaron had been right all along and he was just restoring the true religion. In some ways, this new religion mimicked the old one. There were feast days, whichever he chose, and there were priests, but not from among the Levites, and there were animal sacrifices, but they were made in the high places, at new temples, rather than at Jehovah's temple. And so Jeroboam and the people put on a religious show with all of the outward appearances, but none of the true God who ought to be the core of the whole thing. This bad behavior sparked an exodus of Levites from Israel. The Levites were the priestly tribe. They had no specific land allotment, but had been dispersed among the tribes so that they could perform ministerial duties. Well, in Jeroboam's Israel, their services were no longer needed, and I have no doubt that they were also persecuted for endorsing the one true God, who was now viewed as the national emblem of Judah. Last week, we skipped over 2 Chronicles 11, 13 through 17, which describes how they left Israel. That passage confirms that Jeroboam had made idols of calves and goats and had set up a new priesthood for them, casting the priests and Levites out of their priestly duties. So they, still seeking the true God, went to Judah and Jerusalem and served Rehoboam. Of course, God wasn't happy about the new religion Jeroboam had invented for Israel, and so he responded by sending a prophet. The prophet is unnamed, but he went to Jeroboam from Judah. He met Jeroboam at Bethel, where he had kept his southern calf god. Jeroboam was holding a religious service in which sacrifices were being offered on an altar. The altar was something like a large grill on which sacrificial animals would be burned. The prophet delivered Jehovah's message consisting of three parts. First, that a man named Josiah from the house of David would be born. Second, that this Josiah would sacrifice the priests of this false religion. And third, that he would burn human bones on the altar. His message was to be backed up with a sign. As we have said many times, a sign was some supernatural work that would demonstrate that the prophet spoke with God's authority. The sign, in this case, was that the altar would split open and ashes would pour out of it. I imagine that this declaration was highly disruptive to the services. And of course, Jeroboam did not at all like it that there was a disruptive person saying something bad about his actions in religious worship. Probably he was embarrassed to have his own bad conduct, as a leader, pointed out. Whether this disruptive Judean was right and acting on God's authority was beside the point. And so Jeroboam did exactly what one might expect a wicked person to do in such a situation. Jeroboam called on his entourage to seize the man, evidently in an effort to silence him or punish him for speaking out. But when Jeroboam stretched out his hand to point at the man, the hand dried up. That appears to be literally the correct translation, dried up. But what exactly it means for a hand to dry up is unclear to me. This could metaphorically mean simply that the strength of the hand failed so that he could not pull it back, or more literally, it could mean that he suffered some kind of miraculous depletion of water within his hand such that it looked like the dried-up hand of an old corpse. Or maybe it was anything in between. Perhaps, lacking precise medical terminology for a supernatural event like this, the author is grasping to give us a clear description. Whatever it was, Jeroboam pointed at the prophet and then could not pull his hand back, and this miraculous occurrence suggested that the prophet actually had spoken from Jehovah. And then also, the sign the prophet had spoken came to pass. The altar split open and the ashes poured out. Now that, in itself, is not miraculous, but predicting it so perfectly certainly was. Jeroboam, rough a character as he was, could clearly see that he had been wrong and that the prophet had been right. And not only that, but he could see that he was in a desperate situation. Something had to be done about that suddenly disabled hand. He asked the prophet to intercede and pray for his hand. The prophet did so, and Jeroboam's hand was healed. Another miracle. One would think that with signs like these, Jeroboam would have repented and torn down the false religion that he had erected, but he didn't. What he did do is invite the prophet to come home for dinner. Knowing Jeroboam, I'm not entirely sure if this is because he had a change of heart about the prophet or if it is because he was setting a trap for him, but either way, the prophet refused because Jehovah had commanded him not to eat or drink while he was on his mission. Why Jehovah commanded him this is not at all clear, but the prophet left following Jehovah's command that he take a different road home than the one he took on the way in. And we'll have more on that prophet's journey home next week. In applying the passage, first and foremost, I think we need to recognize clearly that idolatry is wrong. The first commandment is that there is only one God and that we should have no other gods. The second commandment is that we should make no image of God to worship it. It appears that Jeroboam did both of these things. Certainly he made images which cannot at all reflect the true glory of God and set them up for people to worship. Now, it isn't entirely clear whether or not he intended these idols to serve as representations of Jehovah or some other newly invented god. He did ascribe to them the miracles of the Exodus from Egypt, but either way, this was a sin. So let's be clear about this. It is wrong for you to worship any god other than Jehovah, the triune God of the Bible, who is the Father, the Son, Jesus Christ, and the Holy Spirit. It is wrong for you to offer prayers to nature, or a cult leader, or to your ancestors, or to dead saints. And it is wrong for you to make an image of God, or of any other thing, and to worship or pray to that thing. I presume we need no more discussion on that, since the matter is well established. However, to more thoroughly discuss an issue that is more specific to this passage, Jeroboam's lack of trust is illustrative to us. Here's the heart of the story. God made Jeroboam a promise. A prophet appeared to Jeroboam and told him that Jehovah would give him the northern tribes and that he would be king over them. It came to pass. That promise was unconditional, and God kept his promise. But then God made another promise with a condition. God promised Jeroboam that he would give him all that his soul desired. He promised that he would build him a house like the house of David. Those are big promises. The house of David was the wealthiest in the world. The Davidic dynasty will endure in Jesus Christ forever. It appears to me that God promised Jeroboam everything that he could possibly want. But there was a condition. The condition was that Jeroboam listen to and obey God's commandments. That's it. If Jeroboam would just show up and honestly do the job, serving one God, not worshiping idols, not committing adultery, not murdering people, not stealing, etc., then he would have everything he wanted. It seems that with the requirements being really not that hard and the rewards being so unimaginably good, Jeroboam should have been inclined to take the deal. So why didn't he take it? The answer is that Jeroboam did not trust God to fulfill the promise. Explicitly, the passage tells us that Jeroboam believed that if he did what Jehovah told him, then he would get the exact opposite of what God had said. He believed that continuing to worship Jehovah would lead the people to reunite with Rehoboam and that he would be killed. He could not have been more wrong. God had said that he should do this and then receive everything he wanted, but Jeroboam believed that he would do this and then die for it. Jeroboam had heard the prophet deliver God's message, but obviously he either didn't believe that the message was from God, or he didn't believe that God was telling the truth. Jeroboam's actions, setting up a cult of golden calf worship, were a reflection of his lack of belief, and those actions then seriously weakened Jeroboam. For example, he lost the Levites who had been in Israel. Jeroboam reigned for 22 years, with his reign being characterized by sickness and war, and his dynasty ended when his son was murdered only 2 years after taking the throne. Jeroboam could have had it all, but he threw it away by acting out a lack of trust. Trust is an inherent component of the Christian life. We believe in God because there is good reason to believe in God. There is evidence that His word is true, but there are many things that we can't see and can't evidence that we must take on our trust in what God has said. He has said that those of us who believe will have eternal life. We're promised a new world in which there is no mourning or crying or pain, but we can't see that. We also can't see that there is eternal punishment for those who will not believe. We believe these things because God sent a prophet who said it. We trust it and we act accordingly. Likewise, we can't create some definitive test that God is hearing and responding to our prayers. We can't definitively prove that God supernaturally responds to manipulate our conditions. While we've seen a general trend that those who obey God get better outcomes in life, we still have to take it on trust that our obedience will bear fruit. Often, our circumstances will strongly suggest to us that obedience to God is not the right course of action. That's what happened with Jeroboam. God said one thing, and his rational thinking about his circumstances led him to believe another thing. Often, we will have a similar experience of temptation. God tells us what to do, but we think something else looks better. Sinners think that their sin looks like the better option, otherwise they wouldn't sin. I think of the devil's deal that some churches have been making in the past few decades. Sound teaching has become unpopular. People don't like hearing that sin is sin. They don't like rules. They don't like things like traditional biblical gender roles, and so many pastors succumb to the same temptation as Jeroboam. They decided to make a change in their teaching rather than watch their members go for the door. But it appears to me that that idea isn't working out for them. Having a no-rules atmosphere may bring more people in, but those aren't the people you want. They're people who won't live right. They'll make church a burden. Particularly in the area of gender roles, that can be highly detrimental. Many people will show up to a church with a lack of gender roles, but will they have healthy families? Will they have many children? Will they keep those children in the faith? Our church is small, but I'm confident that our obedience in this regard will bear much fruit in the long run. Meanwhile, more liberal churches are aging. They're full of elderly people whose daughters went off to college and never came back to give them grandchildren. They're dying. The sin looked good at first, but it ends up bad in the end, and all sin is like that. David learned that with Bathsheba. His adultery with her rocked the kingdom. Solomon learned that with his idolatry, which split the kingdom. And Jeroboam learned that as well. I encourage you, then, to be attentive to this in your own life. Know the scriptures that you may know God's commands, and then, when you are faced with a situation in which something else looks better, make a habit of trusting God by choosing to follow His commands. To conclude, this week we have studied Jeroboam and his sin of idolatry. After the split between Israel and Judah, Jeroboam set up calf idols in Dan and Beersheba, instituting a false religion to keep the people from returning to King Rehoboam of Judah. It was a bad plan doomed to failure. Jehovah had promised Jeroboam everything if Jeroboam would only serve Jehovah faithfully, but Jeroboam trusted in his own reasoning over God's promise. As a result, a prophet came to condemn Jeroboam's offering, demonstrating Jehovah to be the one true God. And so we are reminded to avoid false gods and idols, and to put our trust in God into practice by obeying God's commands instead of our own whims. Next week, the prophet's story continues. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.